Tesla shareholders recently voted overwhelmingly to re-ratify a $48 billion stock option package that the company's board of directors had granted CEO Elon Musk in 2018. The Delaware Court of Chancery had rescinded the deal 5 months earlier. Now Musk can exercise nearly 304 million options to purchase Tesla shares. William Lozonik is a retired professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and one of the authors of a recent article on Musk's stock option package and its implications for the transition to electronic vehicles. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
So, Elon Musk and his compensation package, $48 billion in stock options, is that unusual or unprecedented? Does that go way beyond what even most CEOs get?
Yeah, so it's totally unprecedented. But the article that I wrote with Matt Hopkins, it's on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, points out that this is not a compensation package. It really looks like a compensation package because executives get stock options as compensation, but it actually, he's had three packages, one in 2009, one in 2012, and one in 2018, which were designed to give him control over more shares of Tesla. Now, as a result of that, he also...
Did he orchestrate that, or was that...
He orchestrated that. He was the chairman of the company, so he was basically employing himself in the United States. There's obviously controversy about this, but it's quite typical for the CEO and the chairman to be the same person, which basically means the board of directors is supposed to oversee the employee. The CEO is actually being led by the employee who is the CEO as the chairman. And of course, it's well known that the CEO handpicks the people on the board unless they're challenged. And that's really what the whole thing is about, is that particularly once Tesla went public in 2010, partly to raise some money, partly because they were paying a lot of their employees in stock options, which were compensation, where they would exercise the options, then sell the shares, put the money in their bank accounts. This was a little different for Musk. Musk came in basically in 2004. About 6 or 8 months after the company was founded, with money that he had got from the sale of PayPal. He subsequently put in $315 million of his own money in an early stage. So he got founder shares, a certain number of shares for that. And now the company was trying to develop a product. They developed the Roadster. And then the second product was the S, which came out in 2012. The Roadster came out before the IPO in 2010. And Tesla was not profitable, but had a plan to produce a series of cars that would become more affordable to the public, both because they would get more economies of scale over time and because they would actually produce cars that were somewhat less high end, although all of them are quite high end in terms of software and their quality. And ultimately, they after 2018, when he got the last stock option package, the one that's being debated, that was rescinded by the Delaware court early in 2024, that is then reapproved on June 13th by the Tesla board, and depending how you calculate it, but it's really about $44 billion before taxes, about $30 billion after taxes, that got reapproved. Now, at that point, they knew at Tesla that within a few years they'd be profitable. Although there was a lot of short sellers, a lot of people who were bidding down the price of their stock, that didn't really matter so much to Tesla per se, because it wasn't raising money really from the stock market. It was raising money from getting money from the sale of its cars by this point. But what Musk knew and the board knew is that once it became profitable, the hedge funds would not just be short sellers. They would be coming in to try to grab control of the company, and he was vulnerable. He could be ousted, and so
he needed voting power.
He needed voting power, and that's what it was all about. And we go through it in the article, different points in time that basically He had well over 20% of the voting power when they gave him that options package in 2018. When that, now that didn't, he didn't automatically get those stock options. They had to meet performance criteria, mostly related to production goals, which is actually not usual in pay packages. Pay packages, the stock price goes up, the executives get their 20 million, 30 million, 40 million, or whatever. It can be 200 million, but not 44 billion. Okay. The quantity of shares that were there were to get his control up toward around 30%. Now, he had to wait till those vested. I think it was 2021 or 2022. And by that point, however, he made a rash move, which everybody knows about. He bought Twitter. And when he bought Twitter, without those options in the 2018 grant, or two earlier ones where he got more shares, but this was the big one. Without those options, once he had to sell shares, about $34 billion of his Tesla shares to buy Twitter, he was down to about 13% of voting power. And there he would be vulnerable to a hedge fund activist coming in, lining up institutional investors, getting Glass Lewis and ISS, the proxy advisory services, to recommend against him, which actually they did, at least in terms of this stock options package the second time around. Now, they do have, it's one vote, one share, but there is a, in their part of their constitution, you might say, there is that you need a 67% of the votes to have a major change, like getting rid of the CEO. But that still meant that he was not totally secure unless, he, let's say, over 25%, totally secure with 33% or 34% of the votes. But now the problem was once the judge rescinded this 2018 package, he was not up over around 20%, but because he had sold those Twitter shares, he was down around 13%. So that's why it was so important for him to get it back. Now, obviously, the corollary of that is that they're worth a hell of a lot of money, way more money than they would have given him as just pay.
What does all this mean in terms of energy transition?
Well, what it means is that what people have to, that this isn't just how much pay he's getting or whether it's fair to the shareholders or not fair to the shareholders. I mean, he could make the argument that the value of Tesla went up so much, even that 44 billion, you know, was a bargain for shareholders. If he could argue that, you know, he alone did it, you know, he had a big role in it. He didn't do it all himself. He hired all kinds of other people to do it, but credit where credit is due. He started a company, or he came in right at the beginning, invested in a company that no one had ever done this, had done, really created a new car company since, you know, for ages, decades. I mean, DeLorean tried to do it back in the late 70s, early 80s and failed.
That's probably a collector's item, huh?
Yeah. Was busted for cocaine smuggling, trying to fund the company. But in any case, or at least it was accused of that. In any case, it was done. And this is but this is not just another internal combustion engine car company. This is a pioneer company in producing pure electric vehicles or battery electric vehicles. They invested in charging stations, and they had collaborations with the Japanese and with the Chinese on batteries. And they put it all together. And there's no doubt that Tesla is the pioneer in having a mass-produced electric vehicle, all-electric vehicle, that pushed everybody else who was in position to do this to move faster, including BYD in China, which is really up there with Tesla. But that is in part.
So in a way, Musk is a great innovator.
And SpaceX has been a success. A lot of government funding, but they have Starlink, and they're launching these rockets, reusable rockets.
But is he overreaching? Is he?
But here's the point that we make in the article is that really it's about control. It's not about compensation. And so the question, let's say the public policy question, or the question we should be concerned about, I'm not concerned about it from a shareholder point of view, that we could be concerned about having this pioneering electric vehicle company in the context of the EV transition, where General Motors is really spending money on stock buybacks, shooting itself in the foot in terms of the transition, just making its profits on the big gas guzzlers, same with Ford, really not making that transition. So this is the big hope of the U.S. and the big player in the global economy. And how is he going to use that control? And he's shown himself more and more in terms of to be quite impetuous, doing things that he thinks that he should do, but may not be good for everybody else. I mean, and here is a guy, who went into Tesla saying the world needs green energy, and we need to make that transition. Now he's just put in not only say that he would vote for Trump, which means you're voting anti-EV transition. I mean, Trump's been quite clear about that, but that he'll give his campaign through a super PAC $45 million a month, $180 million over the next 4 months, to try to get him elected.
Do you think he sees himself as a kind of Ayn Randian type?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think that's partly it. I think it's that he thinks it's all him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that without him, it would fail. Without him, it wouldn't fail now. Probably it is the time to bring in someone who can run it as a company for the sake of the company. So it's a difficult, now that's a difficult thing to do in the United States, because other things that I've talked to you about and I've written about is what happens when companies are successful. The vultures come in, the hedge fund activists, and they start getting the company to do all kinds of stock buybacks. So in the article, we give the example of Apple, which has done well over $650 billion in stock buybacks, something like 55 or 50 billion a year or 56 billion a year since 2012, October 2012, to keep their stock price up. But this has been mainly because Tim Cook and Al Gore is on the board, want to keep their jobs. They don't give all that money away to help the people who want to sell the shares and get a higher price. They're going to come in and do it themselves. So, and that's happened in many, many cases at DuPont, at General Electric, at what a number of companies where the hedge fund activists have come in, tore them apart, and try to get the shares up. They get the shares up without having to tear them apart, fine. But that's what Musk is afraid of. And we quote him, and he calls them at one point dubious interests, but we know who he's talking about, and we know at the examples that he's looking at. I'm sure the last thing that Musk would want to do now that Tesla was profitable, I think it was $15 billion last year, is do stock buybacks. I mean, for one thing, those shares, he's not looking to sell the shares. Because he wants them for voting control, that $44 billion, he's not going to go out, sell the shares, and pay the taxes. So this is another important way it works, is that when he gets the stock option package, it takes some time under any circumstances for the shares to vest. Usually it's up to 4 years for all the shares to vest, even if there's no performance criteria. In his case, he had performance criteria. He met most of them, and that increased the amount of shares that he could get. Okay, by 2021, 2022, they're vested. Okay, now they're vested. He still has another 6 years to exercise those options. Okay, I think they go till January something, 2028. He's not going to exercise the options. He's not going to actually have those shares in his possession, because the minute he does that, he has to pay taxes on them, on the income, and he's going to have to sell some $10, $12, $13 billion of shares to pay the taxes. But what he has now is exercisable options, not exercised options. But he can exercise them tomorrow if there is a raid on his company and he needs to have that voting power in his possession. At that point, he would go and exercise the options and have those shares pay the taxes on them. There would also be some loans might have to pay back, because actually the way he's funding his own lifestyle and whatever, even some of his other companies, is by taking loans as collateral with the shares as collateral. So it gets a little complicated. We explain it all in the article.
Do any other companies operate like this?
No. Okay. Well, that's a really good question, because it's...
Or is it like comparing the Clinton Foundation with other foundations?
Yeah. Okay. There's other ways. We go through this in the article. There's other ways where he could have what we call strategic control unchallenged if he had a different shareholding structure. Okay. Then two. One would be dual class shares, which Google, now called Alphabet, has, and which Facebook, Meta, has. And the Google went public in 2004, Facebook in 2012. So Tesla was right in between. And one of the reasons, the main reason why they went public with dual class shares, that is shares that gave their founders voting control. So it was really the shares that the founders have, Page and Brin in the case of Google, Zuckerberg in the case of Facebook, have 10 votes for every one votes of the shares that are traded on the market, the other class of shares. In the case of Google, it was the A shares had one vote each, and they're traded on the market. The B shares were controlled mainly by the two founders, and they had, let's say, coming around 2012 or so, about something going down toward 50% of the votes, because they were giving more and more shares out to employees for stock options and also for some acquisitions. So actually, at that point, what they did is they created a third class of shares, which have no votes. And that's what they give out to employees. And right now, Brin and Page, the last proxy statement says that they have a 51.7% of the voting power, but that now won't change because they're not issuing any new A shares with votes. And by the way, the reason they changed their name to Alphabet is because of the ABC shares, because they went to that shareholding structure and then they adopt that name, which is something most people probably don't realize. Okay, so Musk was unable to do that back then when they did the initial public offering, because first of all, both Google and Facebook already had billions in revenues and were profitable at the time they went public, so they could do the flotation well, saying the founders are going to control the company and unchallenged. Second, they were also household names. So everybody was, Tesla was not a household name in the sense that everybody was using Google or Facebook at those times. So that opportunity, even if they considered it, they probably wouldn't have been able to do the IPO. The market wouldn't have bought it, because it would just be given all this control to a guy who at that point was, you know, maybe a crazy entrepreneur, had not proven himself even with SpaceX. Both those companies almost went bankrupt around 2008, got NASA money, helped keep them going. So he wasn't able to do that. The other way that he could have done it, and this is, if he could have done this even if he hadn't bought Twitter, if he had really looked at the option carefully, and that was to do what Michael Dell did at Dell Computer, and that is take the company private. So Michael Dell, who had founded that company as an 18-year-old in 1984, and then the company became a leader in, you know, computers, personal computers during the internet boom and just after. By around 2003, 2004, those computers were becoming somewhat commodities. There was a point where they actually had Dell leave as a CEO, brought in someone else to try to run the company. He was still the chair of the company. He was still very much involved, had a lot of the shares still. But around 2012 or 2013, Carl Icahn was buying a lot of shares in Dell and was challenging the control of Michael Dell. So Michael Dell said, hell with this. I'm going to find a private equity firm to lend me the money to buy up all the shares in a tender offer and go private, which he did. It was at the exact amount, 34 billion or 23 billion. I forget exactly what it was, but it was a lot of money.
Is Icahn still around, by the way?
Oh, he's still around. He's still around bothering lots of companies. So now Dell, Michael Dell, with Dell off the stock market, he had to deal with his private equity partners, but they gave him, he still had control basically. And they bought up EMC, a big storage company, VMware, and they came back, and now they're back on the market as a listed company again called Dell Technologies. But they came back on the market as a known company that had gone off the market and had really gone from just having their computer, you know, personal computer commodity things to having much more sophisticated technologies. And he was able to go back on the market with dual class shares. So he has about, I think, 60% voting control. His partner, Silver Lake, has, I think, 17%. So he's unchallenged. That's where Elon Musk would like to be now. And now he did think of this because is when he was being hit with by all the short sellers, I believe in August of 2018, I believe, he tweeted out, it was a 9-word tweet that said, I'm going to take the got the funding to take the company private at $525, something like that. He was later charged with security fraud by the Security and Exchange Commission, forced to step down as chair of the company.
So there are some regulations.
Yeah, some regulation, because he basically had kind of roiled the stock market by putting out this tweet without due process, due diligence, you know, whatever the process that should have gone. So he should have gone and said, okay, line up the private equity firm, line up his financing, and then done a tender offer. If he had done the process properly, he might have been able to pull it off. And at that time, the shares were actually pretty cheap relative to what they are now. Of course, if you're going to do that, you want to go and do it, not when your shares are sky high, but when you can acquire them more cheaply. But he didn't. So he was very impetuous in this. And then also in the, as he was with the Twitter acquisition, where he kind of tried to take it back afterwards. He had a litigation, tried to get out of the deal. And that also says something about him as a person. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't look at CEOs from that point of view, but we do know their behavior matters because they have making decisions that affect, in his case, 140,000 employees. He had no problem laying off earlier this year, 20,000 employees.
That was from X, right?
Yeah. No, but he did that. Oh, X.
Tesla, too?
He about 80% of the employees at X in a year, and it's now worth a lot less money. But at Tesla, because sales were slowing, he just said, okay, let's cut the labor force dramatically. And we have in the article, we talk about how when the head of the division of the supercharger division, which is very important to Tesla's success to have that supercharger network out there, because now you're really trying to sell cars to people who have range anxiety. And are they going to be able to, you know, get the electricity in their cars, recharge their cars as they go on long trips or even in the city? He had pushback from the head of that division because he wanted to lay off some of them. He then laid off everybody in the whole division, which seemed like a pretty rash thing to do, because a lot of those people had relations with various governments, local governments and state governments, various places to put in these supercharger stations. And so he seems to be acting in a very, very kind of impetuous, rash.
Well, he's fairly young, right? He's going to be.
Well, he's in his early 50s, I think. Yeah.
Think that's the, what they would say, the impetuous nature of youth?
Yeah, well,
you guys would say he's in his 50s. But.
Well, no one would charge him with being a Joe Biden, you know. But he has other characteristics that may be worse, given the power he has. And I think that's important, because I think there's no way getting around it. If you're running a company, any company, what we call strategic control, the CEO has to have, and the team around them have to have a lot of power, because they have to allocate a lot of money, strategic decisions, decide who to employ, not to employ, how to compete. And, you know, that just doesn't just happen. So the abilities and the incentives of the CEO are extremely important. But often those abilities might be used against the company. The incentives might be used against the company. And so that's the question we're asking about Musk. And one of the things that he, for example, when they took the Delaware court, rescinded this options package from 2018, that was last January, on the grounds that it wasn't done properly. They might actually do it again now that they re-ratified it, but basically, when they did that, Musk then saw his voting power go down to about 13%, and he said, if I'm not going to control Tesla in the future, then I'm not going to use Tesla's money to invest in AI and robotics. Basically, I'm going to sabotage the company while I'm in the head, because I'm not going to let someone else take it over the company that I built. You know, you don't want someone like that running a company. Now, one of the points we make, a big point we make, in fact, is that the whole system of who gets the control of these companies are corrupt. You know, that we've argued in many contexts, you have to rein in these hedge fund activists who do absolutely nothing or these companies, people like Daniel Loeb and William Ackman and Nelson Peltz and Paul Singer and Carl Icahn. But
so, I mean, do the courts and the regulatory agencies really have a handle on this, or is this just
no? So the SEC over time really has, if anything, enabled the hedge fund activists. And there's this notion that anybody who has shares is, or these people portray themselves, they know how to fix a company. They know how to extract a lot of value from a company, and they're not there to fix the company. They're not there to make it competitive in the future. And again, our point of view as academics, as citizens, as people looking at how the economy does better for worse and for whom, is how can you ensure that a company that this point is not easily replaceable, Tesla, actually builds on its competitive advantage and delivers high quality, low cost cars to the market, employs a lot of people in good jobs, builds up the capabilities. If you look at it from a US point, the capabilities in producing electric vehicles, possibly, you know, upstream also batteries, where the US actually does not have its own EV battery producers, which it should have. That's a whole other story of why that's not the case, which has to do a lot with corporate financialization of chemical companies, of companies like Apple. For example, when Apple was doing all these buybacks, it could have been investing in its own rechargeable batteries for all its devices. Rather, it got the devices from a company called Amperex Technologies in China. That now is a company called CATL, which is the biggest EV battery producer in the world. So basically, there's a lot of implications understanding what this was all about, that it was not about, you know, pay. As we said, it's, if CEO pay was sky high before, this is an outer space for Musk, but it is about control. The number of shares and the value of the stock is stuff that he's not going to turn around and sell unless he does another acquisition like Twitter, which he's not going to do. But it's stock that he's holding in order to have control. And the question is, how is he going to use or abuse that control?
That's retired University of Massachusetts economics professor William Lozonik speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on August 5th, 2024.